Lecture 2. Alexander the Divine.
In 338 BC, the Macedonians defeated the Greeks at the Battle of Chaeronea. Philip II was victorious after a career spent planning to extend his reign and his territory. He defeated the Athenians and the Thebans, but he proved to be magnanimous in victory. He sent Alexander, his 16-year-old son, who had commanded the left wing at Chaeronea, to bring back the ashes of the Athenian war dead to the city of Athens as a mark of respect and of honor for fallen foes. So at the age of 16, Alexander was clearly marked for greatness by his father. He had been given the highest military command in Macedon, other than that of commanding the right wing of the phalanx, which Philip had done, and he had now acted as an ambassador on behalf of the king to the most prestigious of the southern Greek states. Clearly, Alexander at 16 was the heir designate to his father, Philip II. And yet, as we saw in the lecture last time, affairs in Macedon could change very rapidly, and the conflicts within the royal family were sometimes hard to fathom and could be certainly dangerous to the health of the people who ended up on the wrong side. A year later, by 337, Alexander had fallen out of Philip's good graces. And the reason for this, and this probably ended up contributing to Philip's murder in 336, was that late in his life, Philip had taken yet another bride. But the difference was, whereas we've seen his earlier brides tended to be from regions around Macedon, and they were brides whom he married because of alliances that he needed with outlying tribes, on this occasion, Philip had betrothed himself to a young Macedonian girl named Cleopatra. Her father, Attalus, was one of the Macedonian nobles who formed the officer corps of Philip's army. And at the betrothal feast for the celebrating the upcoming wedding of Philip and Cleopatra, Attalus proposed a toast, drinking the good health of the bride and wishing the happy couple a fruitful marriage that would produce a legitimate Macedonian heir. One can imagine Alexander's reaction. Was he not the Macedonian heir? Well, perhaps, but he was certainly not, in the eyes of some of the other Macedonians, a legitimate Macedonian, because his mother, Olympias, was actually a princess from Epirus, the kingdom located immediately to the west of Macedon. So that, from one point of view, Alexander was only half a Macedonian. And the toast of Attalus was clearly a slight at Alexander. But more than that, it also raised the possibility that if Philip, who was still a strong man, were to father a child on this young girl, Cleopatra, that child might be or might become the heir designate if the child grew to be, say, 20 years of age while Philip was still alive. So Alexander's rage was prompted both by the immediate insult and by the sudden spectre of his being shunted out of power. He flew into a rage at the wedding feast. He drew his sword, stood to Attalus and said, "What does that make me? A bastard, you villain?" At which point, not Attalus, but Philip drew his sword. And the two men, the father and son, both in rage, nearly cut each other to pieces until they were separated by the other men and soldiers at the feast. It was a dramatic rupture in what otherwise appeared to be a smooth motion towards power by Alexander. His mother withdrew from Macedon, estranged from her husband Philip. Alexander temporarily left as well until he was persuaded that Philip would accept him back again and that they should resolve their differences. But in 336, in the following year, when Philip marched into a festival behind the statues of the Olympian gods and a statue of himself as well, and on that occasion when Philip was cut down, there was still bad blood between him and his son, despite the fact that only 2 years earlier they had celebrated the most glorious military victory of Macedon's history. Philip entered the theatre, was stabbed in the chest, and his assassin shortly afterwards was cut down as well. Now, there were many theories in antiquity about the death of Philip. There were stories that Philip had failed to intervene when his later assassin had been dishonoured, and that the man had held a grudge against Philip. But there were also those who claimed that Alexander had engineered the whole thing, and that the death of the assassins rather conveniently covered the trail so that Alexander came to power unhindered. We'll never know the truth. Some modern scholars have believed that Alexander was implicated, but there is simply not enough evidence, and you cannot hold a man in court 2,500 years after events like this have passed. The charge can't be proved, but it is certainly true that Alexander profited mightily by the timing of Philip's death in 336. As we saw last time, at the time of his death, Philip was actually planning the invasion of Persia. He was going to lead a combined army, not as the conqueror of Greece, but rather as the captain general of all the Greek forces in a war that would avenge the Greeks for what had been done to them by the Persians 130 years earlier. And Alexander simply took over the plans that his father had already laid. In 334, he crossed the Hellespont, and in good Macedonian fashion, he hurled his spear into the ground. The claim that Asia Minor was spear-won territory was the claim that began the campaign of conquest against the Persians. Now, the first of Alexander's three great victories over the Persians came early in his campaign. It was shortly after crossing over into Asia Minor that Alexander was brought to battle by the forces of the local satraps, or provincial governors, left in charge of the area by the Persian king. This took place at the Granicus River in northwestern Asia Minor, and Alexander was entirely successful. Now, I'm not going to spend a great deal of time in this series of lectures on the details of military history, although it's a fascinating topic, but there is one aspect of the victory at the Granicus River that deserves to be mentioned. The ancient sources put the victory down to the reckless courage of Alexander, and it is true that throughout his career, Alexander led from the front, always putting himself in danger before endangering the lives of any of his men. And the effect of this, I think, was to make his army feel astonishingly devoted to the personality of that one man. He was a very, very successful commander because his men loved him. But it's actually not that point that I want to make about the Battle of the Granicus. It's this. Up until this time, the major battles fought by the Greeks, either amongst themselves or against the Persians, had been battles won by the forces of their infantry. Hoplites, heavily armed soldiers wearing a shield that protected them from the neck to the knee. And then a bronze helmet and bronze greaves below meant that the individual heavily armed Greek infantryman was wearing 60 pounds of bronze armor. And these men would stand in close formation with their shields protecting both themselves and also the body of the man next to them as well. And it had been the mass of these men that had won the victories in Greek battles up until now. People have sometimes observed that Greek battles were often like tugs of war, with the two sides pushing against each other until one side broke and the other side followed. But Alexander introduced a change in tactics, a dramatic change. Prior till now, the cavalry had only been used either on the wings to skirmish at the edges of the hoplite battalion, or once one line had broken, the cavalry would pour into the gap that had been created and would cut down the forces of the enemy as they fled. Cavalry had not really been used as a tactical weapon, but now Alexander appreciated the potential of the cavalry to break the enemy's forces, that an attack of cavalry could shatter the line, create a weakness and a break into which his phalanx could then pour, splitting the enemy. And so, while the ancient sources emphasize Alexander's bravery, and it certainly had its effect, I'd like to emphasize his military intelligence, his keen understanding as a tactician of the potential of both infantry and cavalry. Once the cavalry had broken, and once the heavily armed Macedonians then hit the opposite line, the battle turned into a rout. You have to imagine that most forces in the Persian army would be made up of lightly armed infantrymen, men carrying either wicker shields or leather shields. They were no match for the heavily armed Greeks and Macedonians. In fact, in most of the battles between Greeks and Persians, when it was a close-fought fight, it was because the Persians were using Greek mercenaries. So it was the Greek army versus the Greek mercenaries in the Persian army that usually proved to be the essence of the battle. So Alexander, already in 334, has begun his campaign. He's still a young man in his early 20s, and he has won a victory over the great king, the forces of the Persian king. He now begins to think about how he's going to present this entire campaign, how it will be packaged, both to his Greek audience and also to the Persians. And naturally what he does is to think in terms of epic and mythic events in earlier Greek history. He begins to think of this as a new Trojan War, with the forces of the Greeks coming east into, in this case, Persia. And he begins to think of himself as a new Achilles, a character straight out of Greek myth, a character who is the son of a goddess, something more than just human, but rather of heroic status. Now, when we use the term hero, we usually mean somebody who's simply done something courageous. To the Greeks, the word hero means something else. A hero is a man who, either by his descent or particularly by his actions, has actually achieved a semi-divine status. He may be the son of a god or the son of a goddess, or he may be someone who, like Heracles, has done such wonderful deeds, the labors of Heracles were famous, that he's actually been taken up into heaven. These men are not human like you and me. They are superhuman. And the Greeks think of this as a separate category of being. Alexander, I think, already in his early 20s, is propagating that image and may even be believing it himself as well. Plutarch tells us that he used to sleep at night with a dagger under his pillow and a copy of Homer's Iliad, as if he could imbibe overnight in his dreams the very essence of being a Homeric hero. And so it wasn't long before people began to compare his campaign, which had already broken out of the confines of the Greek world and had marched into Asia Minor, as a campaign that was like the labors of Heracles. Heracles himself had wandered far and wide away from the Greek world. Remember that even Gibraltar was known to the Greeks as the Pillars of Heracles, because he'd gone that far west. And the Greeks also worshipped a god, Dionysus, who was known for having come from far in the east. So that the notion of an epic journey, a journey that went far beyond the normal confines of the Greek world, was something that the Greeks were already attuned to thinking of as the work of a god or a hero. And that's what Alexander was plugging into, making these comparisons between himself and these characters, casting his conquest of the East, therefore, not merely as a campaign of vengeance against the Persians, but as a divinely sanctioned campaign, with himself in the role of either hero or god. The victory at the Granicus River left Alexander in control of much of Asia Minor, the area that corresponds to what we would now call Western and Central Turkey. And it was followed a year later by another victory of Alexander's at the Battle of Issus, as it's called, in 330 BC. Now, southern Asia Minor, southern Turkey, has running along it a range of mountains known as the Taurus Mountains. And between the Taurus Mountains, with Turkey on one side and now Syria on the other, there is a narrow pass, the only pass that allows you conveniently to march an army from what would be now Turkey into Syria, from Asia Minor into Syria. And it was through that pass that Alexander marched his troops, and strangely enough, the Persian army and the Greek army, or the Macedonian army, actually passed each other in the night. And so it ended up that the Persian forces were closer up to the mountains, and it was the Greeks who occupied the more open territory. This was a fortuitous turn of events for Alexander, because the Persians had a vastly larger army, but were not able to deploy it on great open ground where they could use their numbers to their advantage. The Persian army at this stage was led, in fact, by the great king himself, Darius. And so this was a momentous event in 333 BC as the great king, the King of Kings, the one anointed by Ahura Mazda, came all the way across to the western provinces of his empire to face this Macedonian interloper. And here, the Battle of Issus in 333, Alexander once again was stunningly victorious, vanquishing completely the Persian army. And so now, in only 2 years of campaigning, and with only two battles, Alexander had extended the possessions of the Macedonians and the Greeks from the Aegean, their original homeland, all the way to the headwaters of the Euphrates River. If you look at that on a map, you'll find that that essentially doubles the landmass under the control of the Greeks in 2 years and two battles. Now, I talked in the first lecture about the scale of the Hellenistic world, and we get some taste of it here. The scale of these victories cannot be measured by the Greeks. It is so much larger than anything that has ever happened before. And because it is off the scale of what the Greeks can comprehend, it raises some very interesting questions for Alexander. No Greek and no Macedonian has ever faced the issue before of how to deal with the Greeks and how to deal with the Persians, both as subjects within the same empire. What is the basis of his authority? He's not the ancestral king of Persia. He wasn't born the son of the Persian king. So how should Alexander behave towards the Greeks and the Persians? Well, we're fortunate in that we actually have documentary evidence to give us a clear idea of what Alexander thought of his authority at this stage of his career. To the Greeks, he simply styled himself as King Alexander. He doesn't say Alexander King of Greece, nor does he say Alexander King of the Macedonians, but I think that that is probably what he implies. Simply King Alexander, something greater than they've ever seen before. We have a wonderful document that comes to us from around 334 BC, and I want to read you some of it, because it is a document that contains a decree of Alexander's. A decree written to the people of the island of Chios. These are Greeks who are now behind the line of advance, and they've written to Alexander to ask him to settle their internal affairs. And what you'll see in this document is a good illustration of how Alexander is dealing with his Greek subjects. A letter from King Alexander to the Chian people. All those who have been in exile from Chios shall return home. The constitution that exists in Chios shall be democratic. Law writers shall be chosen to write and correct the laws in order that nothing opposed to the democracy or the return of exiles shall be in the laws. Whatever has been corrected or written shall be referred to Alexander. The Chians shall provide 20 manned triremes at their own expense, and these triremes shall sail as long as the rest of the fleet of the Greeks sails with us. And so it goes on with a few more stipulations. What is very significant about this is that we see a combination of interesting idealism and practicality. The practical stipulation in here is that the people of Chios have to provide 20 boats for Alexander. He's still marching with a Greek navy following closely along the coastline in support of him and to make sure that a Persian fleet doesn't come in behind Alexander and either destroy his lines of communication or attack him from the rear. So that's a practical stipulation. But at the same time, we find that it is Alexander who is guaranteeing that the Chians shall be a democracy. In other words, they're not going to be ruled by a Macedonian garrison or a Macedonian commander. They'll be free, or in the words of the Greeks, autonomous, to govern their own affairs. So Alexander's genius expresses itself here. He recognized that the best way to get the Greeks on side was, in fact, to rule with a very light hand. Unlike many of his successors, who would impose their rule directly on the Greeks, Alexander essentially left the Greeks to rule themselves, with the proviso that, when they redrafted their laws, they would send them to him for ratification. He's acting as a kind of supreme court, if you will, to make sure that everything is exactly as he wants it to be. So here we have King Alexander, the Macedonian king, the legal expert, ruling very lightly and encouraging the autonomy of the Greeks. But to the Persians, a completely different story. To them, Alexander presented himself quite differently, because he now had defeated the Persians twice in battle, and he demonstrated that he was the equal of the great king. And so, to the Persians, Alexander presented himself as a character every bit on a par with Darius. We have a letter that Alexander apparently wrote to Darius, and here you'll find, I think, that the tone of his communication to the Persians is very different from what he has to say to the Greeks. And I want you to listen to what he says about his own authority. He writes to Darius, "Your ancestors invaded Macedonia and Greece and caused havoc in our country, although we'd done nothing to provoke them. As supreme commander of all Greece, I invaded Asia because I wished to punish Persia for this act. I took the field against you, but it was you who began the quarrel. First I defeated in battle your generals and satraps, now I have defeated yourself and the army you led. By God's help, I am master of your country and I have made myself responsible for the survivors of your force. Come to me, therefore, orders King Alexander, as you would come to the Lord of the continent of Asia. Should you fear to suffer any indignity, I will give you the proper guarantees. Come then and ask me for your mother, who Alexander had captured in this battle, and ask me for your wife, who he also had captured, and your children, and anything else you please, for you shall have them, and whatever besides you can persuade me to give you. And in future," he says, and now we hear the king talking to his fellow king, "let any communication you wish to make with me be addressed to the king of all Asia." So Alexander to the Greeks is something very different from what he is to the Persians. Now you may wonder why I'm belaboring this point. Clearly, the way you deal with your own people and the way you deal with an enemy is going to be somewhat different. That's fairly obvious, yes. But what I want to do here is to establish an important point, I think a fundamental point in the interpretation of Alexander. Alexander was caught between two cultures that had very different ways of viewing the world. Two cultures that had very different ways of understanding authority and power. And what I'm going to be suggesting is that Alexander couldn't reconcile the difference between these. That in fact, you cannot be the first among equals, as you would be as a Macedonian, with being a semi-divine supreme autocrat, as you must be amongst the Persians. So the beginnings, I think, of a deep conflict between the cultures is to be found right here in Alexander's correspondence both to the Greeks and to Darius. After the Battle of Issus, Alexander turned south to secure the coastal cities of Tyre and Sidon. And from here, before pursuing Darius inland, which would be the last phase of his victory over the Persians, Alexander instead headed for Egypt. Now, I want to talk about this episode for a moment because this is really quite a critical moment in Alexander's career. First of all, why did he go there? Well, people will be talking in a moment about the oracle of Zeus at Siwa, which Alexander went to visit, and that's going to be an important part of his reign. But we shouldn't neglect something more basic, and that is there is a tactical and strategic reason for going to Egypt. You do not want to leave a large Persian province, as Egypt was at this point, in your rear as you march inland east across towards Iraq and Iran. You don't want to do that because Persian forces back there may invade Greece, send a navy towards Macedon, and you'll find yourself having to scurry back again. So he is establishing his conquest in an orderly fashion to make it possible later to march further east. This explains his campaign in Egypt in general, but as I'm sure you're all aware, the Kingdom of Egypt, which was now a Persian province, is essentially just the Nile Valley and the delta of the River Nile. But when Alexander marched into Egypt, he didn't stay just in the delta and just on the river. He didn't merely go to Memphis. He marched further west, even further, going across the coastline of the Mediterranean as far as the modern-day location of Mirza Matru, and then turning south and marching into the desert until he came to the oracle of a god known as Zeus Amon, located at Siwa, at the oasis of Siwa. And what happened here is a story that has bedeviled historical analysis for many, many years, because it appears as if Alexander was greeted as the son of a god. And it also appears as if he entertained that belief quite seriously thereafter. Now, there are many conflicting stories about this, and I won't go through all of them in detail. In some stories, when he arrived at Siwa, he wanted to find out about his father, and so he asked about Philip, but the oracle said, you shouldn't assume that Philip is your father, which made Alexander think, ah, perhaps it's a god rather than Philip. Such double parentage with a human father and really a divine father is very much in the Greek tradition, and that may be what happened. Another story is that as he walked towards the temple, the priests came out to visit him, and they had meant to say, oh, Paideon, oh, my little boy, my young one, but that their Greek wasn't so good, and when they said it, it came out sounding like, oh, Paideou, oh, son of Zeus. So perhaps Alexander's belief in his own divinity was based on simply a rather poor pronunciation of Greek. But I'd like to suggest another interpretation, and that is this. By conquering Egypt, Alexander became pharaoh. That's a simple given. If you conquered Egypt, you were once again the pharaoh. And the Memphite priesthood, the priestly group that ruled in Memphis and gave continuity to Egyptian culture for so many centuries, would have recognized Alexander as the new pharaoh. And one of the titles of pharaohs in late Egyptian history, during the Persian period and now in this period, was son of Amon. So it is quite likely that in his visit to Egypt, Alexander, in taking on the role now of the pharaoh, in proclaiming himself the inheritor of that royal authority, was ritually recognized with the title son of Amon, and that when he went to Siwa, that same title was bestowed upon him by the priests there in recognition of the fact that it was not merely a Greek or a Macedonian who was visiting their oracle, but rather it was the pharaoh of Egypt. Now, that makes sense of the events, and it's an explanation of how he came to be known as the son of the god, but what's much more important is what Alexander himself did with this. I've suggested already that he sees himself as another incarnation of the heroic character like Heracles and Dionysus. Being greeted as the son of a god may strike us as being incredibly arrogant, but in fact it fits in with the model of Greek thinking already before Alexander, that the great man might be able to accomplish a higher status and become godly, as the Greeks would call it, the theos aner, the godly man. So it's quite possible that Alexander was not merely going through the motions of taking on an Egyptian title, but that he actually was coming to believe this as well. And that in the latter part of his career, Alexander wanted to present himself as a god, as a divine man, as the two together. I somewhat hesitate at advancing that particular view for the simple reason that to give it real credence, we'd have to psychoanalyze Alexander, and we can't do that. As we're going to see in a later lecture, so much of what we know about Alexander is a result of the way that different sources in antiquity wrote about him. And there was so much romance, and there were so many popular stories that getting back to the original is very hard to fathom. But what I think we have seen so far is a man who was very aware of the need to package himself to an audience, both to the Greeks and to the conquered people as well. Whether to the Persians, writing to the great king as the Lord of Asia, or in this instance to the Egyptians, taking on the role of the pharaoh. And what we find here, I think, is the key to Alexander. He is a man who is trying always throughout his career to reconcile the irreconcilable, to reconcile the demands of Greek culture with the demands of the cultures of the conquered peoples in the Hellenistic world. He makes attempts to reconcile those, by presenting himself to his different audiences in different ways. But finally, I'm going to be arguing he's unsuccessful in those attempts. And the best proof of that will be that in the generation after Alexander, none of his successors will try to do the same thing that he did. The great tragedy of Alexander, to my mind, is going to be that none of his generals will attempt to be both Macedonian and Pharaoh in the same way as did Alexander, the blazing star.